You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of the 10th and last lecture, but a discussion will also be recorded, of the Light Course, a cycle of lectures Steiner gave to the newly formed Waldorf School and its teachers, given in Stuttgart on January 3rd, 1920. Today, to conclude for the time being these few improvised hours of reflections on the natural sciences, I would like to give you a few guidelines that can be useful in creating your own nature studies based on characteristic facts you can demonstrate experimentally for yourself. In the natural sciences, it is very important for teachers to find their way to the right forms of studying and thinking about what nature has to offer. In this regard, I was trying to show you yesterday that since the 1890s, the course of physical science has been such that materialism has been turned on its head. It is this aspect that you should emphasize most. We have seen that an era that believed it already had ironclad proof for the universality of wave phenomena was followed by an era that couldn't possibly hold on to the old wave or undulation hypothesis. The last three decades in physics have been as revolutionary as we could possibly conceive anything in a given field to be. For under the press of the facts that came to light, physics has lost nothing less than its very concept of matter in the old form. We have seen that the phenomena of light were brought into a close relationship with electromagnetic phenomena and away from the old way of looking at things, and that the phenomena of electricity passing through rarefied air or gas tubes led us to see something akin to electrical emissions in the light emissions themselves. I am not saying that this is correct, but it did happen. And we achieved that by eavesdropping, so to speak, on the course of the electrical current, which, in leaving the wire and jumping to a far distant pole, can't hide what it contains in the matter that it goes through. Before, it had always been shut up in wires and could hardly be studied, except according to Ohm's law. Because of this, something very complicated came to light. We saw yesterday that first the so-called cathode rays were discovered, which emanate from the negative pole of Hittorf's electron tubes and pass through a space with rarefied air. Those were the phenomena I demonstrated for you, of course. Because these cathode rays could be diverted by magnetic forces, they revealed a kinship to something we normally regard as material. On the other hand, they are also related to something that we perceive in rays. This can be shown particularly vividly by carrying out experiments by which these rays that come somehow from the negative pole are captured, as light would be, on a screen or some other object. Light throws shadows, and radiation of this kind also throws shadows. Naturally, precisely because of this, its relationship to the ordinary material element is established. Because if you imagine that we are bombarding from this point, then the bombs would go through the barrier, and what is behind it remains untouched, as we of course saw yesterday, in accordance with Crookes' ideas about what is happening with the cathode rays. We can illustrate this particularly well by capturing the cathode rays as in Crookes' experiment. We will produce the electrical current here, then conduct it through this tube containing a partial vacuum, which has its cathode, the negative pole, here, and its anode, the positive pole, here. Readers aside, I'm sorry there's no picture here referenced, so I'm not sure there's not one in the next few pages, so he might be speaking of hopefully a picture that you've seen earlier. End of readers aside. By driving the electricity through this tube, we get what are called cathode rays, which we then capture with the attached screen that is shaped like a diagonal cross. We have them strike it, and you will see that something like the shadow of this diagonal cross becomes visible on the other side, which tells you that the cross blocks the rays. Please consider this carefully. The diagonal cross is inside here, the cathode rays go this way and are blocked by the cross sitting here, and the shadow becomes visible on the back wall. Now I will draw this shadow that becomes visible into the field of a magnet, and I ask you to observe the shadow. You will find that it is influenced by the magnetic field. Do you see? Just as I attract any other simple object, say, of iron, what has emerged here as a kind of shadow behaves like external matter. In other words, it exhibits the behavior of matter. Thus, on the one hand, we have a type of rays here that for Crookes could be traced back to radiant matter, an aggregate state that isn't solid, liquid, or gaseous, but a finer state. And that shows us that in its flow, electricity as a whole behaves like simple matter. We have focused our attention on the current of flowing electricity, and what we see there reveals itself to be like the effects we see within matter. Now, because it wasn't possible yesterday, I also want to show you how the rays that come from the other pole arise, the ones that I characterized yesterday as anode rays. You see, the difference here between the rays that are coming from the cathode, which are going in this direction and shimmering with a violet-like light, and the anode rays, which are coming toward them at a much slower speed and give off a greenish light. I also want to show you the type of rays that arise by means of this device here. They will reveal themselves to you in that the glass becomes fluorescent when we pass the electrical current through it. Here we will get the type of rays we can otherwise make visible by passing them through a screen made of barium platinocyanide, which have the characteristic of making the glass very strongly fluorescent. You see the glass. I want you to focus your attention mainly on this, in a very strongly greenish-yellow fluorescent light. The rays that appear in such a strongly fluorescent light are none other than the X-rays I mentioned to you yesterday. So we've taken note of this kind here too. Now, as I've told you, in the pursuit of these processes, it turns out that certain of these entities that were regarded as substances emit whole bundles of rays, initially at least three different kinds, which we classified as alpha, beta, and gamma rays, and which reveal characteristics that clearly distinguish one from the other. These substances, called radium and so forth, emit yet a fourth substance, which is the element itself. The radium sacrifices itself, so to speak, and after being emitted, transforms in such a way that while the radium is streaming out, it changes into helium, thus becoming something quite different. In other words, we are not dealing with a constant substance, but with the metamorphosis of the phenomena. To follow up on these things, I would just like to develop an aspect that can become a path for you into these phenomena. Indeed, the path into natural phenomena in general. You see, the chief reason that the thinking of 19th century physics became sick is that the inner activity by which people sought to pursue natural phenomena was not agile enough in the human being, and above all was not yet capable of entering into the facts of the external world itself. We could see color emerge in and under light, but we didn't rise to receive color into our thinking, into our imagination, into our thinking. It was no longer possible to think colors, and we replaced the colors we couldn't think with something we could think, something that is merely kinematic, the calculable vibrations of an unknown ether. This ether, however, is tricky, because it doesn't present itself whenever you seek it. And all these experiments actually showed that flowing electricity does indeed reveal itself as something that exists as a phenomenal form in the external world, but that the ether doesn't want to present itself at all. Now, It just wasn't given to the thinking of the 19th century to penetrate into the phenomena themselves. However, from this moment onward, that is exactly what will be so necessary for physics, to go deep into the phenomena themselves with the human imagination. To do that, certain paths have to be opened up, particularly for the study of physical phenomena. We would like to say that by approaching closer to the human being, the objective powers have actually already forced our thinking to become more agile. But we would say that this has happened from the wrong starting point. What we regarded as a sure thing, something that we relied on the most, was of course what we were able to explain so beautifully with calculation and with geometry. In other words, with the arrangement of lines, of planes, and of bodies in space. But the phenomena in Hittorf's electron tubes force us to approach the facts more closely, because calculation indeed actually fails if we try to apply it in such an abstract form as the earlier wave theory did. First, I would like to talk to you about the starting point from which something like a compulsion came to make arithmetical and geometrical thinking become agile. Geometry is very old. The way that we imagine the laws of lines, triangles, rectangles, etc., on the basis of geometry, is an ancient inheritance we have applied to the external phenomena that nature presents us. However, in the face of 19th century thought, this kind of geometry began to totter. It happened in the following way. Transport yourself once again back onto the old school bench. You were taught, and it goes without saying that our dear Waldorf school teachers teach it too and have to teach it, that when we have a triangle and calculate the three angles, those three angles together are equal to a straight angle, or 180 degrees. Naturally, we feel compelled and have to feel compelled to give the students some kind of proof for the fact that these three angles together are 180 degrees. And there's a figure 10A he's going to begin to refer to. We do this by drawing a parallel here to the base of the triangle, saying the same angle that is here as alpha appears here as alpha 1. Alpha and alpha 1 are alternate interior angles. They are equal. Thus, I can simply put this angle over here, again, figure 10A. Likewise, I can put angle beta over here and have the same thing. Now angle gamma stays where it is, and if gamma equals gamma and alpha 1 equals alpha and beta 1 equals beta, and alpha 1 plus beta 1 plus gamma together make a straight angle, then alpha plus beta plus gamma together also have to make a straight angle. I can prove this clearly and concretely. There can't be anything clearer or more concrete, you might say. However, the assumption that we make here when we prove this is that this upper line, A1B1, is parallel to AB, because only then am I able to carry out the proof. But in all of Euclidean geometry now, there is no way of proving that two lines are parallel, that is, that they intersect only at an infinite distance. In other words, that they don't intersect at all. This looks as if they are parallel only as long as I stay with imaginary space. Nothing guarantees that this is also the case with real space. And if I assume only one thing, that these two lines do not intersect only at an infinite distance, but in reality intersect earlier, then my whole proof that the angles of the triangle equal 180 degrees is wrecked. Indeed, in the space that I construe for myself in my thoughts, and with which normal geometry is concerned, the sum of the angles of the triangle is 180 degrees. But as soon as I contemplate a real space, it may be different. Then I would conclude that the sum of the angles of the triangle isn't 180 degrees at all, but perhaps greater. In other words, besides the normal geometry that stems from Euclid, there are other possible geometries for which the sum of the angles of a triangle is not 180 degrees at all. Especially since Lobachevsky 19th century thinking was much occupied with debates in this direction. And in the aftermath, the question had to arise, can the processes of the real world that we follow with our senses actually be comprehended, completely comprehended, with those concepts we generate as geometric concepts in an imagined space? The imagined space is without a doubt imaginary. We can indeed foster the beautiful notion that what happens outside of us, out there, partially coincides with what we cook up about it. But nothing guarantees us that what happens out there works in such a way that we can grasp it completely with the Euclidean geometry we have thought up. It could easily be the case that things out there happen according to a quite different geometry, and that it is only we in our interpretation who translate it into Euclidean geometry and its formulas. Only the facts themselves can tell us the truth about this. That means that initially, if we accept only what the natural sciences currently have at their disposal, there is no possibility for us to decide how our geometric, or more generally, our kinematic concepts relate to what we see out there in nature. We calculate and draw natural phenomena as long as they are physical. However, whether we are only superficially drawing just any outward thing or penetrating into something natural can't be determined for the time being. Once we begin to think really thoroughly, particularly in physics, we will end up at a terrible dead end and see we aren't getting anywhere. And we will get somewhere only if we first educate ourselves about the origin of our kinematic concepts, of our concepts about counting, about geometry, and also about movement purely as movement, but not of our concepts about forces. Just where do all these kinematic concepts come from? We may normally believe that they arise from the same source as the concepts we develop when we involve ourselves in the outer facts of nature and work on them rationally. We see with our eyes and hear with our ears. What we perceive with the senses we process with our intellects in a primitive way initially, without counting it, without drawing it, without looking at its motion. We are guided by completely different conceptual categories. Our intellects are active in the presence of sense phenomena. However, when we start to apply so-called scientific concepts of geometry, arithmetic, algebra, or motion to what happens externally, we are doing something quite different. We are applying concepts that we haven't gotten from the outer world, but have concocted from our inner selves. Just where do these concepts come from? That is the cardinal question. These concepts absolutely do not come from the intelligence that we apply when we process sense perceptions. In fact, they come from the intelligent part of our will. We make them with our will structure, with the will element of our soul. There is a tremendous difference between geometric, arithmetic, and motion concepts and all the other concepts of our intelligence. We gain the other concepts from our experiences of the outer world. Geometric and arithmetic concepts arise from our unconscious selves, out of the part that is will, which has its external organ in the metabolism. Most prominently, for example, the geometric concepts arise from it. They come from the unconscious in the human being. And when you apply these geometric concepts, and arithmetic and algebraic concepts as well, to light phenomena or sound phenomena, in your cognitive process, you are linking what arises within you to your external perceptions. In this process, you remain unconscious of the whole origin of the geometry that you have used. The whole origin remains unconscious. And you develop such theories as the wave theory. Of course, it makes no difference whether you develop this one or Newton's emission theory. By uniting what arises in your unconscious self with what represents your conscious daily life, the sound phenomena, and so forth. You permeate one with the other. But these things don't belong together. They belong together as little as your imaginative capacity belongs together with external things you perceive in a kind of half-sleep. In anthroposophical lectures, I've often given you examples of how human dreams employ symbols. A person dreams he is a student standing at the door of a lecture hall with another student. They have an argument which becomes violent. They challenge each other to a duel. This is all a dream. He dreams that he goes out into the woods. The duel is arranged. The dreamer even dreams that he fires. At that moment he wakes up. The chair has fallen over. That was the jolt that is played out in the dream. Imagination became connected with an external phenomenon in a purely symbolic way, not in a form that suited the object. The kinematic concepts that you fetch up out of the unconscious part of your being are connected in a similar way to light phenomena. You draw rays of light geometrically. What you are doing in this case has no more validity than what is expressed in the dream when you imagine symbolically such objective facts as the bang of the falling chair. This whole way of processing the optical, acoustical, and heat phenomena of the external world by geometric, arithmetic, and motion concepts is in truth a waking dream, albeit a very sober one. Until we recognize that it is a waking dream, we won't deal with natural science in such a way that it supplies us with realities. What we believe to be an exact science is modern humankind's dream of nature. However, if you descend from light phenomena, from sound phenomena, through heat phenomena, into the area that you enter with radiation phenomena, which are simply a special chapter of the theory of electricity, you are connecting with something external in nature that is the equivalent of the human will. The will area in the human being is equivalent to the area in which the cathode, anode, and X-rays, the alpha, beta, and gamma rays, etc., are operative. From this will area in the human being arises what we have in our mathematics, in our geometry, and in our concepts about motion. Only at this point do we enter related areas in nature and in the human being. Nevertheless, human thought in these areas is not yet advanced enough to really penetrate them with thinking. Modern people can dream, thinking up wave theories, but they can't yet grasp mathematically this area of phenomena to the extent that it is related to the area of human will from which geometry and arithmetic arise. For that to happen, our arithmetic, algebraic, geometric imagination itself has to become more thoroughly permeated with reality. And this is precisely the path that physical science must take. These days, when you talk to physicists who were educated in the era when the wave theory was in flower, many of them are quite uneasy about these more recent phenomena, for they are causing arithmetic concepts to break down in every possible way. Of course, in recent times, because completely legitimate arithmetic and geometric procedures didn't work anymore, we have found another way of doing things. A statistical method has been introduced that allows us to connect empirical, numerical relationships more closely to the external empirical facts and to work with calculations of probability. This allows us to say that a given regularity can be calculated that lasts for a certain series. Then a point comes when it doesn't work that way anymore. Such things show how, especially in the course of the development of more recent physics, we may indeed lose a thought, but in the very process of losing it, arrive at reality. Thus, for example, it is easily conceivable, given certain rigid ideas about the nature of a heated gas or heated air, and its behavior vis-à-vis the environment under certain circumstances, that someone could have proven with mathematical certainty that the air could never be liquefied. Yet it was liquefied, because at a given point it was shown that certain ideas that account for the laws of a series have no validity at the end of a series. I could cite many examples of this kind. Such examples show how today, especially in physics, reality often forces people to admit that with their thinking, with their concepts, they are no longer immersing themselves fully in reality. They have to start the whole thing from a different point. To start from this different point, it is necessary to feel the relationship between everything that arises from the human will, and that is where kinematics comes from, and what is separate from us and approaches us externally in such a way that it announces its presence only in phenomena of the other pole. Everything that passes through those tubes uses light to announce itself, and so forth. But the flowing electricity is not perceivable by itself. That's why people say that if we had a sixth sense for electricity, we would be able to perceive it directly too. That's nonsense, of course, for it is only when we ascend to intuition, which has its basis in the will, that we come into the region where electricity lives and works, even for the outer world. Along with this, however, we also notice that in this last area we have examined, we have the inverse of what we have in the case of sound. With sound, the peculiar thing is that because people are simply immersed in the world of sound, as I described it, they live into sound itself only with the soul. Whereas with the body, they only live into something that sucks at the real essence of sound, in the sense that I have looked at things in these last few days. You will recall the analogy to the globe from which the air had been pumped out. It sucks at the sound. With sound, I am within, in the essence of the spirit. And what is observed by the physicist, who naturally is unable to observe things of the spirit, of the soul, is the external material, in quotes, phenomenon that is the parallel of motion, of the wave. If I go to the electrical phenomena of the last area we have examined, I don't have only the objective, so-called material world outside of me, but also what otherwise lives within me, in spirit and soul, as sound. In essence, sound is only present externally. But I am bound up with this thing that is outside. With these electrical phenomena, on the other hand, I have, in the same external sphere in which the case of sound, there are only material sound waves, something that with sound can be perceived only by the soul. With electrical phenomena, I have to perceive physically the same thing that in the case of sound I can perceive only with the soul. In terms of the relationship of the human being to the outer world, sound perceptions and perceptions of electrical phenomena, for example, are at diametrically opposite poles. When you perceive sound, you divide yourself into a human duality, so to speak. You float in the wave element, the undulatory element that can be verified externally. You become aware that there is something more within it than the merely material. You are forced to become inwardly active to comprehend the sound. You become aware of the undulation, the vibrations with your body, your ordinary body, which I'll draw schematically here, figure 10b. You retract your ether and astral bodies together into yourself, which then occupy only part of your space, and experience in the inwardly concentrated etheric astral body of your being what you are supposed to experience in the sound. When you confront electrical phenomena as a human being, at first you perceive nothing at all in the way of vibrations and the like. But you feel compelled to expand what you had previously concentrated, figure 10C. You push your etheric body and astral body out past your surface, and by enlarging them, perceive these electrical phenomena. Without progressing to the human spirit and soul, we will never be able to gain an understanding of natural phenomena that corresponds to truth or reality. We have to imagine more and more clearly how sound and light phenomena are related to our conscious conceptual element. Electrical and magnetic phenomena, on the other hand, are related to our subconscious will element, and heat is located between them. Just as feeling is located between thinking and willing, the external heat of nature is located between light and sound, on the one hand, and electricity and magnetism, on the other. Thus the structure for examining natural phenomena must increasingly become the study of the light and sound element on the one hand, and of the diametrically opposed electrical-magnetic element on the other. And this can happen if we pursue the Goethean theory of color. Just as, in the spiritual realm, we distinguish between luciferic light-bearing, luciferic/light-bearing, and Aramonic/electromagnetic, we also have to study the structure of natural phenomena in this way, and the phenomena of heat that we encounter are located in neutral territory between the two. With that, I have indicated a kind of path for you, guidelines, in which I've tried to summarize for the moment what I was able to present to you in these few improvised hours. Given the haste with which the whole thing had to be put together, it goes without saying that it didn't go beyond my intentions. I could only give you a few ideas, which I hope to be able to expand on in the near future. I believe, however, that what I've given you here will help you, and can especially help the teachers at the Waldorf School when you teach the children concepts about the natural sciences. You have to see to it that you don't teach the children directly. I mean to say in a fanatical way, so that they go right out into the world and say, quote, all university professors are asses, close quote. Instead, with these things, what is important is that the realities be developed in an appropriate way. We shouldn't confuse our children, but at least we can succeed in not mixing too many impossible concepts into our lessons, concepts based solely on the belief that the dream image we construct about nature has an actual external reality. If you let yourselves be pervaded by a certain scientific cast of mind, like the one that pervades what I've presented to you in the last few hours, for example, then that can serve you in the way you talk to the children about natural phenomena. I believe that you can also get a good deal out of it in terms of methods. Although I would have preferred not to rush through these phenomena in the way I had to, you will nevertheless have gathered that we can connect what is observed externally in an experiment with the concepts that are called forth about things, so that we don't simply gape at things, but reflect on them. And if you set up your lessons in such a way that the experiment makes the children think, and you discuss the experiment with them rationally, then, especially in the science lesson, you will develop a method that will make the natural sciences fruitful for the children entrusted to you. Thereby, I believe, I've added something, by way of example, to what I said in the pedagogical course when instruction began at the Waldorf School. On the one hand, I believe that by setting up these courses, we have once again done something that can help our Waldorf School thrive, so that it can really develop. And it can do just that in the wake of its very commendable start. This should be the beginning of work that draws on something new for the development of the human race. If we let this consciousness permeate us, that there is simply so much that is breaking down in what was built up thus far in the development of the human race, and that something newly formed has to take its place, then we will have exactly the right consciousness for this Waldorf school. Particularly in physics, quite a few concepts have proven to be extraordinarily fragile, and this fact has a much stronger connection than we might think with the misery of our times. Isn't it true that when people think in sociological terms, we notice right away how their thinking has gone awry? Most don't even notice that if we are able to notice it because sociological ideas have an effect on human social order. But we don't really form any satisfactory idea of how deeply the concepts of physical science affect all of human life. So we are ignorant of the damage that has in truth been caused by the often horrific ideas of modern physics. Indeed, I have often cited how Hermann Grimm, who for his own part viewed the ideas of the natural sciences only as an outsider, stated with a certain justification that future generations would hardly be able to comprehend that there was once such a crazy world that explained the development of the Earth and the whole solar system on the basis of the theories of Kant and Laplace. Someday in the future, it won't be easy to grasp this scientific insanity. However, there is a great deal today in our ideas about inorganic nature that is like Kant's and Laplace's theories. But how are people going to free themselves of Kantian Königsberger thought and the like if they want to move forward to far-reaching, healthy concepts? We hear of strange things in which we can see that the wrong on one hand is linked to the wrong on the other. It can make your skin crawl to hear such things as the following. Recently I was shown, coincidentally as they say, a copy of a lecture that a German university professor, who even declares himself in the lecture to be a Kantian, gave on May 1, 1918, at a university in a Baltic state, about the relationship between physics and technology. Please take note of the date, the 1st of May, 1918. The man, who is a learned physicist, expresses his ideal at the close of the lecture, saying more or less that the course of this war has clearly shown us that we haven't been able to forge, to an adequate degree, the union between the scientific work of the university laboratories and the military. In the future, so that the human race can make appropriate progress, a much closer bond must be made between the heads of the military, what is happening at the universities. For everything coming from science that can make mobilization especially powerful must in future be included in mobilization issues. At the beginning of this war, we suffered from the fact that this intimate bond had not yet been joined, a bond that in the future should therefore lead from the institutes of experimental science into the general staffs. My dear friends, the human race must change its ideas, and it must change them in many areas. If we can decide to change them in such an area as physics, it will be easier for us to change our ideas in other areas too. Those physicists who go on thinking in the old way, however, won't ever be far removed from this nice little coalition between the Institute of Experimental Science and the general staffs. A great deal has to change. May the Waldorf School always be a place where the changes that are to come can take root. With this wish, for the time being, I would like to bring these discussions to a close. The end of the last lecture, Lecture 10, and there is a following discussion statement.